Thank you. My name is Bob Talon, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 28th, 1986. I'm not reading this. My home group is the Graceland Group in Memphis, Tennessee, and my sponsor is Sparky F. We got to do what we got to do, you know. I'd like to thank Milton and the board for having me here this weekend. It is a distinct pleasure. I've met a lot of friends already, and you are really exceptionally nice people. I may find out different later. That's how I feel right now. Thank you very much for having myself and my wife and making us comfortable, as you already have. I'm going to go ahead and get into this deal. I'm waiting for the chills to start because it's warm up here. I do this differently when I stand up here because it all depends on where I'm at the time that I'm standing up here. So if anyone has heard my talk before and it sounds different, the whole outcome will be the same. But I just bring different things along with me depending on where I'm standing at. And I have never stood at a pulpit in a church before. So I hope that doesn't change anything. I am the youngest of four. My parents died when I was real young, and I talk about this only because I believe this is where my personality started from, and my personality today is entirely different than what it was for many, many years. I had two older sisters and an older brother, and we got split up real young. My brother and I went one direction. My two sisters went someplace else, and they got split up too, even further than that. So I had no parents when I was growing up, and for the people that believe in nurturing and all that kind of stuff, I didn't have any. Thank you. Little audience participation here. My childhood never really bothered me much. It still doesn't bother me a whole lot. I've had a few more chances to think about it since I've sobered up, a little rationally, I guess, more rationally than what I could. I actually had, when I compare it to some people that grew up in real families with parents, I actually had a lot better life than some of them did. But I do know that my personality grew from being alone. Even though I went to the same school as my brother, he was 2 years older than I was. So, and you know, at that age, at like 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, 2 years is a vast difference. So for sure, you're not going to hang out with your younger brother. I mean, yeah. So we both had different friends. We didn't spend a lot of time together, although I knew he was there. And unfortunately, he used to save me every once in a while when I got in fights. I say that's unfortunate because a younger brother does not want a bigger brother doing that. But that was just part of the deal. But I do know that I spent a lot of time by myself from the age of 9 to 53. But in my younger years, I did spend a lot of time by myself. And it really wasn't a bad thing for me. It's really what I wanted. I just didn't want to be a part of a whole lot of other stuff. Nothing else really meant anything to me. I didn't know kids that had two adult family members. I just didn't know them. Most of the kids that I went to school with either had one parent or no parents, so it really wasn't a big deal. I didn't know what a family setting was. I didn't watch too much Beaver Cleaver, you know, TV type stuff, so it really wasn't a big deal to me. And I learned a lot of vocational type stuff in school too, carpenter work and farm work. They actually had a farm. I learned how to ride cows, milk cows, steal eggs from the chicken and throw them at cars, stuff like that. So there was farm work, and I did haying in the summer, so I learned some of that. I thought that was good. Auto mechanics, I learned that at school. Building buildings and maintaining buildings. I learned how to do that in school too. So I learned a lot of that kind of stuff. That was my childhood, fun childhood. when it came to in my 11th grade, I decided I had enough school. I just didn't want school anymore. It just wasn't my type of deal. I didn't quit. I got suspended when I was in, I think, the 10th or 11th grade for a little while for fighting. I stole my first bottle of whiskey when I was somewhere around 15 years old from someone that I'd just spent a weekend with. We got farmed out to different houses for school holidays and weekends and stuff. So somebody had a spare bottle of whiskey, I guess. I just stole it from them and took it back to school and hid it out in the woods and drank it when I could. I don't remember ever getting drunk from that bottle of whiskey, but I remember keeping that bottle of whiskey from anybody else. And I know what it was like. And no ice, of course. It just come out of the woods. So I drank it warm. I know what it tasted like. I know what it felt like. And I felt warm inside. I felt good when I drank that whiskey. And I never drank much of it until, I nursed it till I could finish that bottle. And I remember what my first can of beer tasted like, and for some reason it was warm too. But that was what I remember. And in my junior and senior year, I did some drinking at different parties here and there, but not a whole lot. But I do know that when I drank, I got drunk and I passed out. I may have blacked out, I don't know. I didn't hear too much about it later on, but I know I passed out and I really didn't feel good, but I wanted to do it again. It's kind of strange. I didn't do that with many other things. I really didn't feel good, but I wanted to do it again. So anyhow, in my 11th grade, when I decided I had enough school, but I knew I had to finish school. I really didn't have anything else I could do. So I had to finish school. So I coasted through my senior year in high school. And I'm sure that in the school we had counseling for what we were going to do after we got out of school. But I don't remember ever being counseled as to someone asking me if I wanted to go to college or what kind of vocation I wanted to get into or anything like that. I had nowhere to go. Someone probably talked to me about that stuff, but I don't remember them talking to me about it. So when I got out, I spent a month with a friend of mine, him and his family, one of the few friends that I had that really did have two adult people in his life. He had a mother and father, and he had brothers and sisters. He was at that school because if he either had this option of making good in this school, he was going to reform school. He couldn't do it in public school, so. Well, that's why he was there. But anyhow, I spent a month with his family, and they more or less adopted me, and then I decided to join the service. Had nothing else to do. And I was a little worried about what I was going to do. I knew they weren't going to keep me forever, I had to do something. So I joined the service, and that's where my service time came in. And I joined the service in 62, and I spent 4 years in the Air Force. And that's where I learned how to drink. The first base I got to, I found out that I could go to this place. I don't even know if it was an airman's club or just a pub on the base, but I found out that I could go there and I could buy me a pitcher of beer and sit down all by myself and everything would be cool. I didn't like where I was at. I didn't like being in uniform. I didn't like the work I was doing, even though I hadn't even started it. I knew I wasn't going to like it. I didn't like being an enlisted man, and my first day on the base, I already had an officer chew me out because I didn't salute him when I walked by on the way to chow. I just didn't recognize him as an officer. That's a no-no, especially for a green recruit. But I just didn't like any of that stuff that was going on. But when I found that place and I found out I could get that pitcher of beer, everything was just cool. That was good. And again, I didn't sit with anybody else. I sat by myself at this one round table. It was more like a coffee shop type thing, but they served beer. I could buy me a pitcher of beer and I could get funny feeling, and then go back to the barracks and go to bed or do whatever I had to do and get up the next day and go to work, and after work I could go over there and do that again. And then I graduated to, I found someone else there that would go buy me some whiskey. And I could find out that I could go hide out someplace and I could drink my whiskey. And and feel a little bit better than what I was feeling with that pitcher of beer. And that's the way it started. And I can really accelerate this thing and tell you that I just learned how to drink better. I did it more often. I drank more. And I went on through life until I wound up here. That's really not what happened. I can tell you in a real nice way, like I mentioned this at my birthday celebration a couple days ago. What happened was that alcohol gave me wings to fly, then took away the sky. Y'all know what happened, right? I spent 4 years in the Air Force. Fortunately for me, I did not do any bad time. I got in some trouble with some civilian cops along the way, but for some reason or other, it never got back to the military. So I didn't do any bad time, so I was able to get out in 4 years. What Robert was talking about, and with this conflict going on, and there's very few people that understand this except those of us that were in the military that wanted to be there but couldn't get there, and it's really insane. It really is. But I spent a lot of my time beating up on myself behind that bottle of whiskey because I didn't get there. And those people that were there will tell me, because some of them have, that I was insane for wanting to be there. But they just don't understand. It's like trying to explain alcoholism to someone that doesn't have it. They just don't understand. And I spent a lot of time in the military, as well as years after the military, beating myself up because I didn't get there. I've gone to the wall at least a dozen times, and I've been able to walk that walk one time without crying. And what can I tell you? Well, let's get me out of the military. Milton doesn't like to spend a lot of time in the military either, so. We'll get me out of the military. My last year in the service, or my last 9 months or so in the service, I was at Edwards Air Force Base, California, and I met this woman in a warehouse that I was working, and she was told to leave me alone because I was going to get out in 9 months and go home anyhow, and my home of record was Rhode Island. In reality, I didn't have a home, so it really wasn't a big deal, but I made her home my home. But we fell into something, and well, I can't call it lust because we didn't apply it, so, you know, what can I say? We fell into something, and I got out of the service in June. I worked a couple of part-time jobs in between there, real short. I started my career with an airline in July, and we got married in August. So we'd known each other for maybe 9 months. That's how long we'd known each other. I have no idea how long we dated each other. I was drinking all the time. She swears she knows. She didn't know she married a drunk, but I was drinking all the time, yeah, constantly. I told you I learned how to drink in the service. I didn't quit. I kept experimenting, trying to make it better. But anyhow, we got married and lived happily ever after. No, that didn't work either. We got married in 1966. Somewhere along the way after that, I don't remember if it was the first year or the second year or whatever, I started getting in trouble with the law because I was drinking and driving. They would catch me once in a while when I was drinking and driving. So I was getting DWIs. I started going to jail when I was 17 in the military. I did one time for drunk and disorderly. That's where the civilians came in, but you know, that never got back to the military. I went to jail in Newfoundland when I was up there with the Royal Mounted Canadian Police. They got me. The Mounties Mounties got their man twice up there, but I never got back to the military somehow or other. We split up, separated, slept in separate bedrooms for a little while. How long was it? She keeps my statistics. I don't know. Yeah, it might have been 2 weeks. It might have been a month. I don't know. We're in our young early 20s. Yeah, we didn't split up for long, obviously. But that was our separation. We separated for a while. And it was because of alcohol. Everything that's happened in my life that's been negative has been because of alcohol. In 1972, we had a little girl. We hadn't moved yet. We're still in California. In 1972, we had a little girl. And I thought my drinking was going to change. I heard somebody else talking about that not too long ago. Maybe it was on a tape. But these periods in my life, I thought I was getting more responsibility. When I got married, I thought things were going to change because I wasn't going to have to drink every day. I had a relationship now, and I had a marriage, and I had more responsibility, and things were going to change. And I think I cut down on my drinking quite a bit, but then it just kind of picked up again. And here my daughter come along in 72, and here I thought again, more responsibility, you know, a child, and I'm going to have to cut back on my drinking to take care of this little girl that I was going to love, along with my wife that I kind of loved, and that didn't work either. I'd cut back on my drinking for a little while, but then I just got back into it. I can give you all kinds of excuses for this: the woman that I married, the job that I was working, the shift that I was working, no parents when I was young, all this kind of stuff. All kinds of reasons for me to drink, but. So that didn't help any. And we moved to Idaho. I'll run through this pretty quick. I've been in jail in Rhode Island, Newfoundland, California, Idaho, Washington, and Arizona. Every time I went to jail, it had to do with alcohol, regardless of whether it was DWI or drunken disorderly or whatever it was. I've been convicted of 8 DWIs. This is so you know my sanity when I got here. I've wrecked cars, trucks, motorcycles, whatever. I could quit drinking any time I wanted to, but that was my only friend, so I had to hang on to that. We did move from California to Idaho, and Idaho, it was more prevalent. You always had your gun rack with your gun in your pickup truck and your six-pack or your fifth of whiskey beside you, and that was perfectly fine with me. So I'd get drunk and get picked up by the cops and go to jail. We moved from Idaho to Washington, Washington to Arizona, and Arizona to Tennessee. I was told in April of 1985 that I was going to have to move to Memphis, Tennessee from Phoenix, Arizona. So in April of 1985, I got picked up for DWI. And I moved to Memphis, Tennessee, and in June of 1985, I had to go back to Phoenix, Arizona to attend a trial for my ninth or whatever DWI it was at the time. I had every intention that what I was going to do is I was going to go back. I had to fly back there and then spend the night and go to court the next morning. And this is the first time I'd been able to hire a lawyer. I knew this was going to be real serious. And I knew I had to play it right all the way down to the wire. So I went back to Phoenix the night before, and I went out to the airport. I work at the airport, and I went out to the airport to talk to some of my friends, and somehow or other, I got a fifth of whiskey. I don't know how that happened. I think maybe I stopped at the airport bar and had a couple of drinks, and then I just had to go get that fifth of whiskey. And the next morning when I went to court, the lawyer wouldn't even let me in the courtroom because I smelled so bad. I'm sure I wasn't drunk. But that's just the way I am. Fortunately or unfortunately for me, there were two police officers involved in the DWI that night, and only one of them wrote it up, and both of them were supposed to, so they threw it out of court. But my lawyer never said anything to me when he came out of the court. She said, told me that you don't have to go in. It's been thrown out of court. And then she walked away from me. I think that has something to do with insanity. Because I knew I was in a lot of trouble. I can give you all these statistics about the things that I've done and how bad I've been and all that kind of stuff, but only the alcoholics sitting in this room are going to understand what I've gone through in the inside of me. And it started when I was a little kid. It started when I was different from everybody else. It started when I wanted to be alone, but I really didn't want to be alone. It started when I started doing these things that I saw other kids doing, and I knew they were wrong, but I had to do them just because. See, that caused an inner turmoil in me, and I knew stuff was going wrong. I never wanted to be a bad kid. I never wanted to be a bad guy. I never wanted to be suspended from school. I never wanted to steal anybody's whiskey, never mind their hubcaps and whatever else I stole. I never wanted to do that. I wanted to be a good husband. I wanted to love a woman and live with her happily ever after. I really did want that. I didn't want to hurt my wife. I didn't want to hurt my daughter. I didn't want to do any of those things. I wanted to drink some alcohol and feel good and get on with my life. That's what I wanted to do, but I never could do that. I had to drink alcohol to the point where I had overdone it. And I never knew where that point was, where I could be in between. I just didn't know where it was. So it caused a lot of turmoil inside. You know, I know what the pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization is that it talks about in the book. I had a little bit of that stuff when I was a kid. I had a little more of that stuff when I got married and I started treating my wife the way I treated her. I had a little more of that when my daughter was born, and 6 months later I decided she's old enough to take care of herself. I had a little more of that in my last DWI when my daughter is 12 years old and my wife's out of town and I'm working a night shift and I get off at 7:30 or 8 o'clock at night and I know my 12-year-old's at home by herself and I'm supposed to go directly home so I can take care of her and get her to bed so she can get up and go to work the next morning, but I get picked up for DWI and leave my daughter sitting at home by herself to fend for herself. I get a little bit of more of that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization inside of me. You know, the embarrassment getting out of jail is not all that bad as opposed to those other things that I hold up inside myself that nobody else knows about. But it's down inside of me in here, and I'm dying inside. And the only way I can squelch that pain inside of me is to drink some more alcohol. And if y'all don't know how to get rid of a hangover, I'll tell you how. Just keep drinking. Just keep drinking. And that's what I did. I can't tell you the last time I had a hangover. I really can't. Because I drank a lot. I drank all the time. The last 5 or 6 years of my drinking, I believe I could have been picked up at any time, day or night, and I would have blown that balloon drunk. I believe that. Because I drank so much that my body never could work that alcohol. Never could. I had to drink alcohol. I had to do that. There were times when I couldn't get home from work. In Arizona, there were times I couldn't get home from work because I drank too much on the job. There were two things that told me I was not an alcoholic when I got here. One of them, I still had the same wife. 20 years we'd been married. Alcoholics don't keep families. Drunks don't keep families. I can't possibly be an alcoholic. 20 years with the same woman. And the other one was my job. I'd had the same job for 20 years. I had 20 years seniority on the job. Alcoholics don't keep jobs. I'd been drinking on the job for the last 4 or 5 years. That didn't count. My wife was so sick that she couldn't get out of the house. That didn't count. It had nothing to do with it. I was not an alcoholic when I got here. I've been caught drinking on the job. But the people that caught me were so afraid of getting in trouble themselves that they just slapped my hand and told me not to do it again. Or in the other stations that I was in, that we were such a small, close-knit station, as you all know, that we just took care of each other. That's why I still had my job. It wasn't because I was a good employee. I still had my marriage because I couldn't live by myself. I couldn't get out of that marriage because I couldn't live by myself. My wife couldn't get out of that marriage because she couldn't take care of herself. That's where she comes from. That's what she told me. That's my alcoholism. That's how I was when I got here. When I got here, I was not afraid of anyone or anything, and I did not have a problem with alcohol. It was my family. They just wouldn't leave me alone. They decided I had to go to treatment. They gave me an ultimatum, and I don't think I'll go through how it went. What happened was my family got tired of my drinking, darn it. Not me. I was not an alcoholic. But at this point in time, I knew something had to happen. They made it perfectly clear to me that something had to happen, and this is the beginning of my surrender. That's what happened. The beginning of my surrender. I threw up my hands. I said, okay, you can go ahead and do with me whatever you need to do. And they put me in treatment, and I'm walking into this treatment place, and I had no idea where it was. My wife drove me from the doctor's office to the treatment facility, and I had no idea, and still in Memphis, I had no idea where it was at. And I had no idea where I was at for a few weeks after I was there until they started taking us out to meetings and I started watching where I was going. And I finally figured out what part of town I was in. But I spent 7 weeks of their treatment, 7 weeks of their 4-week treatment, trying to get through the first step when they wanted me to get through 5. I asked my counselor when it was time to go if it was okay for me to go on to step 2, and she said, no, it's just time for you to leave. Fortunately for me, when I got out, they had me set up an agenda. I had to have a sponsor, and I had to have an itinerary of where I was going to be going to meetings. A whole week, I mean, all 7 days I had to do this, going to meetings. And I had it all mapped out. Coincidence. I had these meetings set up, and I knew which one was going to be my home group, the one that was closest to my house. And I joined this group, and it was the Hickory Hills group in Memphis, Tennessee. And I joined this group only because it was close to my house. But there were some people in that group that were good old-time AA. And it was, at that time, straight up AA. And they told me what to do. There weren't any suggested steps. I know what would happen to me if someone handed me one of these books and was to tell me, you know, when you get a chance, you might want to try reading some of this. Or there are 12 suggested steps that you could read. And do something with them if you have a chance. Go to a meeting when you can. See if you can't make 90 meetings in 90 days or some kind of stuff like that. Or never 120 in 90 days. So I figured if I can go to 3 one day, then I could skip 3 days. Nobody ever explained that couldn't be done, and I didn't do that anyhow. But see, these things weren't suggested to me. I was told what to do. I was assigned a sponsor, and I called this guy, and his name was Norwood Brawley. I don't know if any of you people might know him or not. Gruff old guy. I really didn't care. He wasn't very personable or anything, you know. And I called him up, asked him to be my temporary sponsor. That sounded a whole lot better to me than sponsor. I had no idea what a sponsor was anyhow. But, so I asked him if he'd be my temporary sponsor. He said, yeah. I told him my name and told him where I'd come from. He said, I know where you come from, what treatment center. He said, I want you to read that big book, and I want you to start with the doctor's opinion and call me when you get done reading it. He hung up the phone, click. I thought, well, yeah, this is real cool. I mean, this guy's, I'm looking for nurturing now, you know. He's supposed to be asking me how I'm doing, how my family is, and all. He never asked me any of that kind of stuff. So I said, okay. And I did have trouble reading the book. This is not an excuse. This is a reality. I had trouble reading the book. I had hallucinations my first year. And I had trouble grasping what was on the page, you know. And I keep it down to a sentence or two, and I'd think about it 5 seconds later. Hell, I had no idea what I said, what I read. None whatsoever. So it was really hard for me to read it. But I did get through. I mean, in treatment, we had someone to read it to us. I thought that was good enough. Well, yes. They understood what they're reading about. Yeah, that's good enough. But I did read it, and I called Norwood back, and I told him I read what he asked me to read. He said, well, good, read it again. Click. Hang up the phone. I called him back, and he says, okay, read it again. Click. And I'm getting used to this by now. And I went to Bill's story, and there's a solution. I don't know how far I got. I think I got about as far as there's a solution. And I met him over at Hickory Hills Group one night when I was getting into this, all of this reading. And my wife was going to Al-Anon, my daughter was going to Alateen, and we had all of that in our group at the time. We had Alouette. I mean, we had all the owls or something running, you know. So we had all this stuff. So I cornered Norwood over at the coffee pot. I said, all right, I got him now. My wife and my daughter were here, and you got to learn who I am and meet my family and all this stuff, and we're going to get this stuff all squared away. And tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Norwood, I'm Bob. I said, the guy you've been having read the book. He said, yeah, okay. And I, when reading There Is a Solution, I said, finish reading There Is a Solution. He looked at me, and shook my hand. He says, it's good. Read it again. He turned around and walked away. Didn't meet my family. I said, okay, that's it. That's it. I fired my temporary sponsor. I didn't tell him, but I fired my temporary sponsors. I knew I could do that. I didn't need him. He didn't care about me. So I trucked on along for a little while doing this stuff by myself. I knew the first three steps. You know, I'd heard it enough, and I knew there was some kind of a problem with alcohol and that my life was messed up a little bit. And that school that I went to a boys' school, and it was a church school, so I knew about church stuff, you know, and God, and I knew there was one out there. He didn't care about me, but there was one there, and so maybe something to work out. So I knew about that first three-step stuff, and I went through that for a while by myself, but I looked around one day, and things just weren't right, you know. You all know about living sober without action. You know, it's living without alcohol, but not really doing anything about it. That's where I was at for, and I don't know how long this was, maybe 3 or 4 months, and it really wasn't doing me a whole lot of good. The only thing that was different was that I was not drinking. That's not much fun. Everything else around me was still the same, you know, and my wife was still what she was. My daughter was still on my case, and the people out of work just, you know, it just wasn't changing any. So something had to happen. Of course, in my infinite wisdom, I knew what I had to get onto this fourth step. I'd been going to meetings like y'all know you've done it. Going to meetings, and the only topic they'd bring up was the fourth step. It's obvious, pretty obvious to me. Someone sending a message here. Coincidence. Just coincidence. All these meetings were on the four steps. I decided, oh, well, that's what I got to do. I got to get into the four step. Well, I had gathered up a whole lot of information. I got Al-Anon's step guide and Hazelden's step guide and Harbor House's step guide. And I went to step seminars, and I had step tapes and all this stuff so I could get into the four step. I remember one of the step seminars, I mean, it was really stupid. I went to a step seminar, and they had three people talking on each step, and I listened to 9 people, and then I left. So now you know how far I got. In case you can't add that up, I left just before they got into the fourth step. That really didn't make much sense. I heard 3 people talking the first, second, and third step, but that was enough. But I still couldn't get into the fourth step. I didn't understand. Well, it's all right. Somewhere along the line, I had seen this guy in the meeting, and we got to be pretty good friends. He had 7 years sobriety, and I liked the way he had talked. And I had told him at one time that if I ever needed a sponsor, I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. He was impressed. So the time came when I thought I probably needed a sponsor. I needed someone to guide me. I was getting a little bit smarter. I knew that I needed some help getting into the four steps. So I asked this guy, and I said, John, would you be my sponsor? He said, yeah. I said, why are you asking me? I said, I need your experience. And it's probably the smartest thing I'd said in 41 years. He says, okay, I'll help you out. I said, I need some help getting into the four step is what I need, because I'd done the rest of that stuff, but I'm just having trouble getting started on that four step. I said, okay, no problem. I said, what you're going to do is, you can read the big book, and it'll explain it in there. I'd like for you to start with the doctor's opinion. So I had to start all over again, and which I really didn't like that, but I guess I must have figured that getting smarter like I was, that he must have known more than what I did. And I did start out in the first step again, and I read what he told me to read, but it got to be a little more personal. He already knew my wife, which that helped. But he was working with me, and I did get into the steps and get through the steps, and it helped me a lot. I learned a whole lot more about me, but see, along the way here, it also helped me that my head had been clearing up, and things were just a little bit better inside here. Nothing out there changed much, but everything inside, some of the things inside were changing. I came to believe that I was powerless over alcohol. I could take a look at my past life now, and I could see that every single time I messed with alcohol, alcohol has kicked my butt. Every single time. It wasn't kind of, wasn't maybe, and it wasn't the last drink even. It was every time I messed with alcohol, I could see where it had kicked me somewhere along the line. It always led into that. So I was realizing a whole lot more that was going on. I came to believe I was powerless over alcohol. And yet my life was unmanageable, no doubt about that. I proved that many times. I tried to patch my relationship with my daughter up for 4 years. It took me to do that, and I still didn't get it done. My life was unmanageable. I came to believe that there was a power greater than me, which was really good for me. And I came to believe that from reading the book. It told me that I didn't have to believe in a G-O-D. I didn't have to believe in God. All I had to do was believe that there was a power greater than me. And I came to believe there was, and that power would help me change my life. That was the second step for me. I learned in there where it says in the book that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. Didn't we hear that not too long ago? And I knew, and I've known all my life, that that's where it was. I knew it all my life. So when I read that on page 55, I knew it. Ah, there is something here. There's something here. So I knew, and I had to reach down inside. And you know, what I really felt like doing was going out there and shouting to the world that I'd been telling all along, that I really don't need your stuff. My wife always sent preachers after me. Every place we went to, California, Idaho, Washington, Arizona, Tennessee, I mean, yeah, there are different cities that we lived in, always sending a preacher or a pastor or whatever they were called after me. And every one of them told me that they would like for me to join their church. But I had to go to their lessons so I could learn their stuff. And I told every one of them the same thing. You know what I told them. But I see, I knew that was wrong. I knew that I did not have to go to their house to learn their stuff about their stuff. And it tells me in the book I didn't have to do that. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. I could grow from there. I could start as small as I wanted. And that sure gave me some relief. So I believe there was a power, and I believe that power could change my life. I also found out that the third step does not say that I turn my will and my life over to God. Now, that's what I'd been doing for 6 months. And that's when I sat down, took a look at my life, and I figured, oh, wait a minute, things just aren't happening. If this power, if there is one, if it's so powerful, why hasn't something changed? I turned my will and my life over to that power. Why hadn't he done it? Why hadn't it changed? Well, in working with this other man, I came to find out that it says, came to believe, or made a decision. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to God. Well, that's not what I saw. So what I did was I made a decision. And y'all can do the same thing right now. Go ahead and make a decision, get up and leave. Well, if any of you have made that decision, you sure haven't done anything about it. That was my problem. I had to get into action. That's what I wanted to do, and that's what step four allowed me to do. And I found out all about me as soon as the pen hit the paper. As soon as the pen hit the paper, I found out about me. I found that four-letter word in there that changed my life. That four-letter word that I couldn't wait for my fifth step to share with my sponsor. I had to call my sponsor up, and I said, John, you're not going to believe what happened. You're not going to believe what I found out about me. He said, what's that, Bob? I said, I'm scared. He said, yeah, I know that. And I told you when I got here, I wasn't afraid of anyone or anything. And I've been running scared all my life, ever since I was a little kid. That's why I hid out by myself. That's why I stayed by myself. That's why that whiskey tasted good to me. That's why that warm beer tasted good to me. That's why that table on that base with that pitcher of beer was good for me. Because it erased all that fear. Just erased all that stuff that I didn't know I had. And see, then when I was getting older and older, getting into my 20s and my later 20s and that, I had this macho image that would chase away that fear. I had this belligerent, obnoxious attitude that would keep you out of my face that would chase away that fear. And the alcohol just topped it off. But I found out about that in the fourth step. And a lot of people talk all about their character defects. You get a list of defects of character and shortcomings, and one's different than the other, and all these things they had to deal with and all that. And that's fine. That's perfectly okay with me. There are steps in there that take care of all that stuff. But I found that fear. I also know that every one of my defects of character, all of my shortcomings, whatever they are, they're just made larger by fear. Every one of them. Now, I may be right, I may be wrong, but it seems to work for me. That I know that what I have to turn over to this power that I believe in my life, and I say the seven-step prayer every morning, so I do ask Him to remove my shortcomings, remove my defects of character, so that I can be of use to my fellows and Him. I ask that to happen, but what I find my action does is my action takes my fears and turns my fear over to that power and allows that power to deal with the fear. That power gives me the strength to walk through these fears. That takes care of my defects of character. I don't have the alcohol to make them bigger anymore. I don't have the self-imposed power to make them bigger anymore. I turn that over to that power that's bigger than me that'll do that. Anyhow, I worked through the steps, and I'd like to go through all of them, but I'm running out of time, and I know you'd rather eat again. But I'm a firm believer in the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it comes in the form of not only 12 steps. That's the beginning of my action. The 12 steps explain the action to me. And it's real powerful. The four step just blew me away when I got into that stuff and I found out about me. And I was more than willing to share that, all of that stuff, with my sponsor. Now, I didn't, by any means, do a complete four step, which means I did not do a complete fifth step. I learned that along the way, the years after that I got into it. I thought I did. I thought I did really good, and I did the best I could with what I had to work with. And I have found out that for 53 years now, I have done the best I could with what I had to work with, even when I was drinking alcohol. I just did not have a lot to work with. I promise you that. My wife can tell you that. My daughter can tell you. The cops can tell you that. I did not have a lot to work with. I was mentally deficient, spiritually deficient, emotionally deficient. And alcohol just helped all that stuff. But I'm a firm believer in the action of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first sponsor left town. He moved to Atlanta, and then he moved on up to Chicago, and I lost track of him. So I asked another man named Wayne Reed to be my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for a few years, and this is a man who had a lot of history, and I really love AA history, and I've learned a lot about that, and I believe I have all of the books that have been written. I do love AA history, and Wayne Reed passed on, and I went and asked that gruff old man to be my sponsor again. And I went up to this man, I said, Norwood, I'd like for you to be my sponsor, and I'll do anything you tell me to do. And you think he told me to read the book again? He didn't tell me to do anything. So he said yes, he would be my sponsor, and Norwood Brawley was my sponsor up until the day he passed away also. And so I know that I can't go a whole lot of time all by myself because I just can't do this by myself. So on the day of Norwood's funeral, I went up to Sparky and I told Sparky, I said, Sparky had been a member of my home group, my first home group, when I came into the program. And he has taught me a lot about resentments and a lot of other things. You can take that however you want to take that. I went up to Sparky at Norwood's funeral and I told him, I said, look, I said, Sparky, I took your inventory about 11 years ago. I said, and it hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot, but I would like for you to be my sponsor if you would. And Sparky told me he would, and I'm really grateful for that. It doesn't leave me out hanging by myself. And the biggest reason why I did that is because when I was looking for a sponsor after my first sponsor left town, I took everybody's inventory because I wanted a sponsor as good as my first one. And I found out all about everybody else's defective character. But at any rate, but it worked out just the way it was supposed to work out, and Sparky's my sponsor now. I have a lot of real close friends in this program, and some of them I give a real hard time to, but it's only, I'll justify this, it's only because I love them. It really is. I treat the people that I sponsor and some of the others the same way I was treated. If someone doesn't need that hardcore AA, then they need to find another sponsor. That's the way I look at it. It worked for me, and I know that not everybody needs to be stepped on. I understand that, and that's perfectly okay with me. Then they need to find another sponsor. But I'm going to tell someone what to do. And I've heard many people tell me that you don't tell drunks what to do. That's fine. But I'm going to tell them what to do. And it comes right from this book. It comes from the people that told me how to do this. I had to have people tell me, and that's the way I treat other people. You know, I'm not a bad guy. I thought I was. I don't want to believe I am now. But I thought I was. But I'm not. But it's the highlight of my life, watching people grow in Alcoholics Anonymous. I spend a lot of time around new people. And it's a pleasure for me to do that. When I first started doing that, it wasn't much pleasure. I thought I was doing it because, or someone asked me to do it because I knew so much, but I found out different. Norwood was the first one to ask me to go out there and talk with some other people and share with them. I thought he told me to do that because I knew so much about the program. And I had 2 years sobriety, I mean, after all. But I found out after a couple of months of doing that really wasn't what it was all about. He sent me out there to do that so I could learn from these people, from these newcomers. I could learn from the newcomers about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did. And I've been doing that for over 9 years now, and I really, really enjoy it. And I'm not patting me on the back. I mean, without this stuff, I can't be sober today. I know that. I just cannot do it by myself. I need you people. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for asking me to come up here on a Friday night so I can enjoy the rest of the weekend. It's a very wonderful crowd, and I sure hope we make it back soon. Thank you very much.